Hello, and welcome to 6 Degrees from the City, a podcast about writing in Western Sydney. I'm your host, Fiona Wright, and I'm delighted to be talking in this episode to the writer and broadcaster, Sheila Njok-Pham. Sheila's non-fiction has appeared in a number of journals and magazines, including Southerly, Overland, Griffith Review, and Peril, and her radio documentaries have appeared on Radio National's Into the Music and Occam's Razor programs. She's also currently undertaking a PhD in bioethics at Macquarie University. Sheila grew up in George's Hall and Lakemba and joined me to talk about the complexities of national history, cross-cultural identity and belonging, and that strange moment stepping out into the wider world and discovering that you're a Westie. Here's Sheila reading from her essay, Black April.
Lebanon and Vietnam exist on different ends of a sprawling continent, but in Australia, these two expatriate groups coexist alongside each other. Nowhere is this more obvious than in the city of Bankstown in Sydney's southwest. On the surface, the two populations continue to be worlds apart, and for many years, the commercial heart of Bankstown was roughly divided along ethnic lines. However, these lines have become increasingly blurred. Leaving Bankstown train station and walking through the centre of town, visitors will likely walk past the Vietnamese Boat People Memorial, a bronze sculpture with four three-quarter life-size figures in a boat. It was created by artist Terence Plowright and was officially unveiled on the 4th of November, 2011. Its plaque reads as follows. In memory of the hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese boat people who lost their lives on the high seas during their journey in search of freedom. Driving by Chapel Road South, we pass Lebanese restaurants full of customers eating later in the evening than we do. I often think, what are the Lebanese? What is Australia's understanding of the civil war that led to the mass exodus of Lebanese from the late 1970s through to the 1990s? How do we, or more to the point, how could we, acknowledge the migratory origins of one of our most significant populations and honour their losses from the brutal civil war the way we're doing with the Vietnamese? When it comes to the way we discuss refugees, for example, the Vietnamese are clearly a bigger part of that narrative than the Lebanese, though that might well be a difference driven by these communities and the way they think of themselves. One of my earliest memories from going to school in Lakemba, not far from Bankstown, was a multicultural food day where everyone was encouraged to bring in a dish from home. I don't recall what I brought, likely spring rolls or some variation thereof, but the only thing I remember clearly was trying homemade kibbeh, a combination of ground lamb, spices and fried bulgur wheat. It would be many years later before I knew what I'd eaten, because I had no name for it then, only the memory of how foreign it tasted, the antithesis to anything I'd ever tasted before. Thinking back to this early episode of my life illustrates how I lived right beside others, but was also estranged from them without much context. Lebanese food, though pleasurable, was clearly a superficial encounter with another culture. These differences matter little as a child in multicultural Australia, where other cultures exist as fuzzy concepts rather than sharply defined realities, but those early years can form the basis of adult understanding. In recent years, I do often ask myself critically, what do I know of what the Lebanese have been through? I went to school with many Lebanese and all I knew was that they were generally funnier and louder than someone like me knew how to be. Others I got to know through work and personal encounters. Like a beautician I went to for many years who gave me the nickname of Wonton, which she eventually shortened to Won, and the way she did it wasn't at all offensive. Some years ago, I became close to a work colleague the same age as me whose family were Shia Muslims from the south of Lebanon. I don't recall her telling me much about her parents' recollections of the war, except that it was a scary time. But I distinctly recall what she relayed about peace. My dad said it used to be so peaceful in Lebanon, a beautiful place where everyone lived together in harmony and our differences didn't matter because we were all Lebanese. Until a few years ago, however, I never knew anyone who was born and raised in Lebanon, and it was this new friendship that led me to visit my friend in Beirut in August 2014. Being there, it was easy to see firsthand why it's still one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the region. We went to dance parties and concerts and gay clubs, ate and drank better than I dreamed possible, and swam in the Mediterranean at a private beach. Thousands of years of history were laid out before my eyes, a history which included the Byzantine and Roman empires, as well as more recent French colonization. The survival of human artifacts over millennia also reinforced a sense of the incredible resilience of both the place and its people. In some ways, these impressions were not so different to what I came away from Vietnam with when I visited for the first time in 2010. Lebanon, like Vietnam, is a country that looks forward despite the unresolved trauma, though there was a certain underlying nervousness in Lebanon which had not been the case in Vietnam. Even to a casual observer like me, the many Syrian refugees in Lebanon were obvious because of their darker features and the way they dressed. My friend's father told me he had hired Syrian labourers to help him complete the building of their new home up in the mountains above the city, paying them half the wages of their Lebanese counterparts. The mountains where the cedars grow were a recurring motif. When asked about the bombings of 2006, my friend and her family described going up to someone's home in the mountains with supplies. They played cards with family and friends and ate, drank, and chatted to pass the time. We just waited till it was all over, my friend said, describing it as though the whole incident was nothing. Her telling of it was also in character because she often shows a brave front in the face of uncertainty. Bengsan calls itself the city of progress. The word progress in this context has always seemed to me like a government platitude, but perhaps it's more than apt, thinking about how the Vietnamese and Lebanese communities are shaping themselves, regardless of external perceptions. What better definitions of progress could we have in light of how these two Australian communities, along with many other groups in the area, continue to flourish in their new home country after surviving some of the bloodiest wars of the late 20th century?
Well, I'd like to talk about Black April first, because I think it's a really startling piece. One of the things I like about it is that it's such a complex engagement with the idea of multiculturalism, you know, put that in inverted commas, in the first place, a sort of engagement that's a little bit uncomfortable but also like deeply empathic and really seems like you've got this sense of really trying to understand, you know, the complexity of a place like Bankstown.
Yeah, I mean, I read that section about Bankstown because I felt like that was relevant to what we're talking about. Mm. But where that piece actually starts is it's about the Anzac and the Anzac myth, actually, because at the time I was working at the ABC and the centenary was coming up and there was a lot of energy, you know, devoted to this. But at the same time, a lot of colleagues, you know, I was working there at the time, a lot of colleagues were also a little bit cynical, actually, I would say, about the way that we kind of could only present a particular view of, you know, that centenary of war. And then it brought to mind, too, and I was thinking, well, you know, April the 25th is when we celebrate Anzac Day. But then April is a month that, you know, has a lot of significance for other communities. And in particular, like, for me, it's always loomed large in terms of, you know, the Vietnam War and the 30th of April being, you know, the day that is, you know, is significant because it's the day that the war ended.
And I think you say in the piece the community's term for that is the day we lost the country.
Yes, I mean, and that's what I grew up with because, so my family are part of the South Vietnamese who left and who lost the country. But, I mean, in Vietnam, that's not how it's referred to. It's the day that the country was reunified as well after it was split.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I think growing up, I don't know that I necessarily engaged with it in that way because for a long time I never met anyone from the other side. I never really met anyone who grew up in the north. Mm. I grew up in Bankstown, which is very much a southern Vietnamese community. And even another fascinating thing too that I only really discovered more as I kind of got older and met other kinds of Vietnamese is that even within Sydney, there are these kind of fault lines about where, you know, Vietnamese communities are and what part of the country they come from. So you'll find that southern Vietnamese tend to gravitate more towards Bankstown, Cabramatta, those kinds of areas. And I think the Vietnamese community that are like in Marrickville tend to be more northerners.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. So those are that's the sort of thing that I started to notice as I, you know, started to get my head around all these issues about, you know, from the outside, everyone just thinks it's all Vietnamese.
Yeah, yeah.
But from the inside, from a young age, I already had a sense that there are a lot of, and I'll call them fault lines, you know, within the community. And so then with something like the war, you know, thinking about Bankstown, you know, all these things, you know, over time, you know, all these ideas start to come together. So I was triggered by thinking around, you know, the 100th centenary of the Gallipoli landing. And then I started to think about, well, and then what about the Lebanese? So that was another thing that I've been thinking a lot about in terms of Bankstown. So I grew up in George's Hall, actually, which is in the Bankstown area.
Oh, fantastic. It's very close to where my nanny used to live on. She was in Picnic Point.
Oh, yeah, very close. So
the other side of the river.
Yeah, and I mean, in fact, I guess it's not where we started out. So we, you know, initially grew up, and I mentioned that in the reading I did. We initially started out around Lakemba and Wylie Park.
Yeah.
So that's where my earliest years were. I was actually born in Adelaide, though, so...
Sorry.
Well, I mean, it's a funny story. I do it sort of half-jokingly, but, I mean, so after the refugee camps, my parents ended up in Pulau Bedam in Malaysia, where lots of Vietnamese refugees ended up. So I think they estimate about 250,000, you know, were from there. And then they were resettled in Adelaide. And then, but after a time, my father thought, oh my God, Adelaide, got to get out of here. Not enough work opportunities. What are we doing here? So, and my dad's very adventurous. And in fact, he was one who organized the boat leaving, you know, Vietnam.
Yeah.
And that's how my mother, you know, met him, because she was a passenger on the boat. So, I mean, that's a very, and that we can go into that later. That's a whole other big story. But then we ended up in Adelaide. And then my dad eventually, you know, learned how to drive, got a car, and then drove all the way to Sydney and started out basically in Lakemba. So that's kind of where we started out as a family. And those are my earliest memories from that area. So I went to school in Lakemba for the first few years. Eventually we made our way to Bankstown. So, and Bankstown, I guess, is where I feel like, you know, I have the longest history with. I lived there for more than 20 years. And George's Hall, though, as someone once described to me, is like a nice part of Bankstown. I don't know what that means.
The nice bit.
Yeah, the nice bit. It's very lush and very green, and there's a river, and there's
very
a park.
Pretty.
It's very suburban, very tranquil. But I guess I think of Bankstown as being, you know, an area that really formed me in a lot of ways. It's where I had my first jobs. And I've always just in and out of that area because I was catching trains. And just on weekends, it'd always be there.
One of my first jobs was at the Gloria Jeans in Revesby, actually.
Oh, right.
That was a trauma of its own. But what I love about that piece is this idea that you're really making a point that we have such diverse national stories, and even such diverse stories around war, and there's so much sitting underneath the surface of that great Anzac myth that is kind of has become this monolith, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess what I was trying to do with that piece, Black April, and in fact another piece which is sort of similar, I guess, is one that was published in Kill Your Darlings, which was called Flags of My Father.
Yes.
And I guess this is the thing, like I think of how monolithic stories about war often are and how it's so difficult to have a counter-narrative in that way. And I know that so well from my own experience growing up with the father that I did, with the background that we have. And then I started to apply that sort of thinking, just thinking about broader narratives of war, broader narratives around flags, you know, these kind of national symbols. And I guess it's something that is always complex. There's no easy answers to some of these things, and that's what's very frustrating. But but with you know, war narratives in particular, the Vietnam War, I mean, to quote a writer, Viet Thanh Nguyen, who won the Pulitzer Prize, he talks about how, you know, war is fought for the first time on the battlefield and the second time in memory.
Yeah, wow.
And I think that's exactly right about every war you can think of. And certainly, you know, in my piece, I specifically deal with, you know, the Vietnam War. And then I raise the question about the Lebanese community, and I raise it as an outsider thinking about these issues. So I don't have the answers to that. And I chose not to specifically go in and read the history of the Lebanese conflict, because that wasn't what I was trying to say. I was just wanted to know that I wanted to explore the idea that we don't really engage with it at a deeper level, but we certainly engage with certain kinds of wars more comfortably, and the Vietnam War in some ways fits more comfortably in with that national narrative as well.
Yeah, with goodies and baddies and causes and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Then the really interesting thing that's happened over the recent years is there's a lot of Viet girl like me who've grown up, and we can see that a lot of us are trying to present different ways of thinking about it and to challenge... you know, the American way of presenting the war, the Australian way of thinking about the war.
I wonder if this is a good time to talk about your mother. I listened to your piece, your ABC documentary about the songs of wartime Vietnam, and your mother figures really prominently in that. And it's such an amazing story.
It is amazing. And I've thought a lot about how all of that started, that story, and it's just started in such a unusual way. Like, it didn't come from my mother. Like, I didn't even really know about her history.
That's what I think is so cool about it, though, right?
Yeah.
Like, I guess it's similar to Black Friday in Black April, Black Friday, in that way that there's this kind of much larger story that then gets you to ask much more specific questions of individuals and individual communities, and suddenly, like, this light goes on.
Yeah, I think that's what's so valuable about for me personally, doing historical research. Mm. It creates a space to then find a way to talk to my parents, essentially. Maybe that's ultimately what all this is about. I just want to talk to my parents, but it's hard to find the language. It's hard to find the kind of the way to approach these things, because we have grown up, you know, in very different contexts. I mean, I was born and raised in Australia. you know, they were born and raised in Vietnam. By the time they came over here, they were fully formed adults already.
Yeah.
And the struggle over the last, you know, well, since I was born, is being able to try to find common ground. So with the piece about my mother's, you know, singing career in Vietnam during the war, but how that started, though, actually had a lot more to do with me trying to reconcile, you know, having this Australian background but this Vietnamese heritage and bringing them together. So, you know, growing up, I listened to a lot of rock music, and that's the kind of music that I liked. But it took me a very long time, not until I was about 29 or 30, to finally ask the question, oh, what were the Vietnamese listening to?
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't something that, and that part of my life, you know, the kind of popular culture interests I developed growing up in Australia were not really things that I shared with my parents. Yeah. It's very different to my husband, for example, where, you know, he's Anglo-Australian, so both of his parents, and so he grew up listening to Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And that was something that his dad, you know, introduced him to. So there's a lot more consistency in terms of, like, you know, passing on, like, those kinds of interests and those tastes and that.
Yeah.
Whereas for when you're a child of migrants, and you, especially migrants who aren't engaged with the broader culture, you basically have to sort of form these things for yourself. And so one day I just suddenly thought, you know, I just had this idea of just bringing them together. I had this question pop into my mind. I'm like, I wonder what the Vietnamese were listening to. So that sort of started this quest, I guess, to try and learn a bit more about music in Vietnam, but especially during that kind of 60s and 70s period, in the 50s as well. And it was just through that process that suddenly I kind of stumbled on the fact that my mother actually sang during the war. But the thing is, and the reason why I don't really know about this beforehand, is my mother's not the kind of person who talks about herself very much.
Yeah.
And my mother and father represents two very different states of being, I think, when it comes to stories. My dad is a huge storyteller. He talks all the time. He tells lots of stories. That's probably where I get it from. Yeah. My mother is the kind of person who, in fact, as I was reading a piece recently, not everyone's narrative, and my mother is an example of someone who doesn't necessarily think very narratively, I think.
Yeah, right.
She's not that kind of person who goes back into the past, tries to reconstruct meaning. I mean, maybe she does at some level, but she certainly doesn't articulate these things.
You know, it amazed me the first time I read that there were people like that. I was just like, oh, wow, not everyone does this thing.
No, but that's right. And I think that's so important. And it was a very critical essay, which I loved. It was in Eon, and it was just challenging this idea that we...
I think it was the exact same essay that I read.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
They used an example of some people are walking through a park, thinking about what they're going to do later in the day, what they did later in the day, bringing up memories, putting them into patterns, making shapes of them, and some people are just walking through the park.
And exactly, right.
Whoa.
And I got into a big discussion on Facebook with one of my friends about this. And then I just started to bring my mother into that discussion because, I mean, at least as far as my engagement with her, and I mean, I I'm 36 years old now. I've known my mother for a long time. I just think that she doesn't necessarily, you know, construct stories in that way. She's very much topical. Like, when I see her, we talk about things that happened that day. It's very rare that we talk about the past. So that's why this making this program was very important for being able to engage with her at a deeper level. But, you know, it's a huge effort to sort of have to go the length of making a documentary to then be able to talk to my mother. And I guess I could have asked her before that, but it didn't even occur to me. And it was just actually serendipity, in fact, that I was recording that concert in Mount Pritchard near Liverpool. And then I came over to my parents afterwards that evening, and then she just mentioned, like, oh, I know Wang Liam, the person that I mentioned, and then that's more or less how it happened.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
It's quite a story, though. It sounds like she was moving around the country, entertaining the troops, just on the other side of the equation, right?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even mention in the piece, but at some point she even ends up going to Cambodia, I think. Like, I mean, which isn't that far away from Phnom Penh. It's like 5 hours by bus. It would have been longer back in those days. Yeah, I mean, she had this quite a big life, you know, before she had me and everything, but I have very little sense of it. Like, I've only heard it from other people, and even my dad is better at telling stories about my mother than she is herself. And even my auntie, who I've written about before when I met her for the first time, she was telling me about my mother growing up and how my mother had a closet full of, like, really beautiful dresses and that. And I have really no sense of this at all for my mother. She just doesn't talk about these things. And that way she's a real survivor. I think she just looks forward. She doesn't necessarily, you know, go over her mind about things that happened in the past. And I just see how we're so different in that way. I'm constantly looking backwards. I'm constantly reevaluating. And that's what really drives a lot of my writing, I think. In terms of
I really get that sense in your writing too. There's a lot of trying to kind of reconcile history with its legacy or to bridge that gap between generations. I kind of had a little giggle when you sort of mentioned maybe understanding my parents is all this about, because in my notes it's like this project of understanding one parents.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, in some way I often joke that that's like one of the big jobs of adulthood, right, is coming to see your parents as human beings with histories and faults and foibles and messing, just making shit up as they go along, just like the rest of us, right? Just like doing what they can. But it's infinitely more complicated when you've got cultural issues and issues of war and trauma and all that sort of stuff hanging around as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Must be.
Yeah, no, but that's right. I mean, everyone, you know, goes through this process if they choose to with their parents. It's a lot easier in some sense when you come from the same sort of cultural context, you know, if you both, you know, grew up and were raised in the same country.
Yeah, because you don't have to cross as much territory. Imagine in your imagination, you've sort of got a...
Yeah.
Yeah, and the landscape's the same.
I think so. I mean, but then what happens is that, I mean, it takes a long time to work out where your parents end and the culture begins as well. Like, it's sort of unclear sometimes about how much of, you know, what your parents are is particular to them, or whether it's something to do with their culture or their displacement even.
Yeah.
At some point, like, you know, because this has been, you know, the project of my life, really, like, up to this point, trying to work all this stuff out before having my own child. But that raises a whole other set of questions as well. But with my parents, I mean, it took me a while to realize, I'm like, oh, my dad's just kind of a weirdo. I mean, some of it maybe had to do with, like, his Vietnamese background about being a migrant. And then now, like, especially now at this stage, I start to see more clearly what's him.
What's the character.
Yeah, what the unique parts of him are that don't have to do with the trauma, that don't have to do with, you know, growing up in Vietnam. Like, I mean, it's sort of hard to explain because it's, you know, and I guess this is what I'm trying to articulate through my writing at the moment. But, I mean, but yeah, but my parents, in fact, both of them, it took me a really long time to understand that they're both black sheep in different ways in their families. And in some ways, I've passed that on to me a little bit. So I've become a bit of a black sheep in other ways as well. But for a long time growing up, I didn't really have a sense of that. I didn't really understand that these were things unique to them.
Yeah.
That they're different to their families, that they're different to other people around them. Like, I really appreciate now how, you know, singular my dad is in some ways. Like, I grew up with a very strong sense of heritage and, you know, myths and stories and that. But I don't think lots of other dads do that, you know.
Yeah.
Lots of dads don't just sit around, you know, casually and then bring up some myth from 2,000 years ago. But that's my dad. That's how he thinks. Like, for him, a lot of these things are very much at the forefront of his mind. And even really fascinating things, like in my husband, because he's Anglo, he's come into this space as well now, and he really gets to hear different stories in some ways because he's a man.
Yeah.
And there's a real gender divide, I think, in some ways. But, for example, we were both there that time where my dad just, it wasn't that long ago, where he suddenly talked about how before the Chinese colonized the Vietnamese, we were more of a matriarchal society.
Yeah, and I was like, wow.
I can't remember what context he brought that fact up. And then I went and Googled it later, and then my dad was right, that the patriarchal, patrilineal perhaps, you know, aspects of Vietnamese culture were introduced for colonization through the Vietnamese. But this is the sort of life that I've kind of grown up with. Just like, but my mother, though, in contrast, going back to this original question, she doesn't ever say things like that. She never really openly talks about those kinds of ideas. It's very rare that I engage with her at an intellectual level because she's just not that kind of person.
I like that you kind of, I think you took that matrilineal story and is that, was that kind of the basis of the piece that you wrote about surnames for Peril?
Oh, no, that, so I wrote this piece about surnames, which I think generated a bit of discussion at the time. I'd actually say that that was a bit more of a pushback against, you know, me now getting my head around this. I mean, I can't think of a better way to describe it than white feminism.
Yep.
I mean,
go for it.
And that's quite a simplistic way of saying it too, but I just start to see this, that feminism sometimes ends up being very exclusionary in the way it talks about practices. So one really fascinating thing, though, is that this whole generation of women our age, there are a lot of women who change their surnames, and it really bothers, you know, feminists, I think, or people who openly identify as that, or maybe even second-wave feminists, who fought really hard to keep their surnames.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking about this the other day. I was counting the amount of women I know around me, educated women, professional women, they've all changed their surnames. But then I started to think about it in my context, in that my mother never changed her surname.
Yep.
So the cultural practice in Vietnam was that women kept their surnames. You could argue that that's also an exclusionary thing too. Maybe women weren't able to be, you know, included, you know, in terms of the family surname. But it sort of made me sort of understand that I occupy an interesting in-between space. Where I do understand the argument of keeping your own surname, you know, thinking about the Western context. But then I thought, well, but if I changed my surname, I felt that that would erase my identity in some ways.
Mm.
Not everyone feels this. And I, you know, and I think about that all the time. Not everyone feels these things. I felt it. I didn't want to change my surname. But then having a child, for example, with an Anglo husband, and then this really kind of, you know, raised the issue in a different way. And then the compromise that we sort of ended up with, which I'm very happy with, and so is my husband, is she gets to have his Anglo surname, but her first and middle names are Vietnamese.
Wonderful.
So, and I think everyone's happy. I feel like, you know, I get to honour that mixed heritage for her. She'll grow up, though, having to spell her name constantly. But then, you know, I was given an English name from birth. Like, my dad was very practical like that. So on my birth certificate, Sheila Ngopfam, like, those are my three names.
Yeah.
But then the funny thing is I was given the most kind of Australian name you can think of, and yet everyone always asks me to spell it. So I'm constantly spelling Sheila, S-H-E-I-L-A.
I was going to say that it's one of those words that I always get my I and my E in the...
And that's what most
spot.
People do. Yeah, I know. And it's just funny because, and that's what kind of gave me a bit of reassurance that ultimately she would appreciate perhaps my baby that of having a Vietnamese first name.
Yeah.
The surname issue, it's very complicated depending on which cultural context. But I guess I just wrote that piece thinking I wanted to challenge the idea that, you know, if you change your surname, it means this. If you don't change your surname, it means that. And that's not necessarily true at all.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you I was talking to Lachlan Brown for the first episode, and he's written a lot about his grandmother and the Anglo name she chose when she came to Australia was Sheila, because that's what everyone was calling her. And his grandpa chose Alan because it was the name on the lollies. I love little stories like that.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't think my dad even chose Sheila for that reason. Like, he chose it because he'd seen a film growing up in Vietnam where there was a character named Sheila, and it stuck in his mind. And I can only imagine that once he sort of brought that name up and then people said, oh, it means girl, he'd go, great, that's a great name for a girl. It means girl. But I don't think that was the initial motivation at all in you know, in choosing my name. The sprawling commercial heart of Vietnam always changes so rapidly, but then I'm always changing as well, altered in some fundamental way by each trip. It's my fourth visit in 5 years to what's officially known as Ho Chi Minh City, otherwise still known as Saigon. On previous trips, I'd spent time with my maternal family, but our fragile bond had fractured again, the decades of disconnection impossible to repair. However, there's an upside to being away from familial connections. I'm freer to wear my different hats now. Australian, Vietnamese, tourist, returnee, foreigner, pilgrim. Min, my host, collects me from the airport on a white vintage Vespa. We'd exchange messages in English, but it's soon apparent that my Vietnamese is better than his English. Older sister, are you hungry? He asks. Although it's intensely hot because of the heat wave sweeping across Southeast Asia, it's food I'm craving right now, more than a cold drink. We stop at a local chain specializing in bún pho Huế. It's the beef noodle dish from Hue in central Vietnam, the former seat of emperors. It's a favourite dish, which reminds me of my mother's cooking back home in Australia. We might be southern Vietnamese, but our family meals covered the length of the country. I'm the first guest Min's ever hosted who falls into the category of overseas Vietnamese, otherwise known as Viet Kieu. I imagine most Viet Kieu stay with relatives when they're in town, rather than paying to stay in a stranger's unglamorous home on the outskirts. Later on, I tell locals I meet that I'm staying with a friend of a friend, because it's strange enough to be a solo female Viet Kieu traveller in her mid-30s. Where's your husband, they'd ask, and I'd tell them the bewildering truth that he was in another country embarking on his own travels. It's only when I say that I'm a writer that a light of comprehension would cross their faces, and my eccentricities make a bit more sense. Min was born in 1985, a few years after me. He wears quirky spectacles and smokes pipe tobacco. Currently a mobile game designer, he works for a startup. If the company doesn't turn a profit soon, it'll probably disappear, he says in a matter-of-fact way. We talk about the future and how much our lives have been radically altered by technology, but we also touch on the past. Like my father, his had been an officer in the Southern Army, but unlike mine, his father had chosen to stay on in Vietnam after doing time in a re-education camp, whereas mine had set sail as one of the hundreds of thousands of so-called boat people after he was freed. Does it bother his father to live under the communist regime he fought against? Min shrugs his shoulders. He's used to it. But he still made sure his children were clear-eyed about the nation they were born in. It's a good life here as long as you don't engage with the politics, says Min. My parents haven't been back since they fled in 1980, I tell him. Over the next 2 weeks, I blurt out that same fact about my parents to every person I meet because their self-imposed exile is top of mind. It saddens me to know that I'll have to keep navigating Vietnam without their input. Min is one of the few people I've met close to my own age whose parents from the South have stayed on rather than leave. Previously, I'd never thought much about how people like my parents were part of Vietnam's brain drain. Yes, they were brave to leave on that boat, but there's certainly something to be said for those who stayed on. They helped to ensure a continuity of culture and helped rebuild the country during the worst years after the war, a place that increasing numbers of Viet Kieu are now returning to, some for holidays, like me, while others seek permanent returns. There's a trauma of emigration and fitting into a new place, but then there's a trauma of going back to where it all began, visiting a place my parents still haven't made peace with. With all that history weighing on me, I find it difficult to be completely light-hearted in Vietnam, a place that's both intensely familiar and intensely alien. Anyone who's close enough to the source of their family's emigration might feel the same, especially if it was a civil war that triggered the exodus. Perhaps the easiest way to explain my relationship with Vietnam, the actual living and breathing country, is it's complicated. But so is my relationship with Australia, the country of my birth.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about this idea of the community, because I think you've got a lot of writing that's kind of about thinking about your place kind of inside or outside the community and what that means, and also as a part of that, there are other people who use that as a way to think about home and where home is. I think there's one person who has an idea about dying at home, despite living in Australia for so many years, and it leads you to kind of wonder where your father, for example, would consider home. I find that so interesting, that kind of, I guess in one of the pieces you read, you referred to that as kind of being between worlds in a way.
Yeah, I mean, this is the other central question of my life probably, is where do I belong, if anywhere? Mm. And probably the answer I have these days is I do feel like I sort of belong everywhere and yet I belong nowhere at the same time. And this is only reinforced by the fact that I constantly move or end up in different countries. And then that really reinforces that idea. That piece that I wrote was about this Vietnamese man dying who... It was, a really sad story. I just sort of stumbled across it, which I explained in the piece, just by a friend. And, he was homeless, essentially, but had this brand new passport, amongst his very few possessions. There was no stamps on it. But, he was dying from cancer. And we can infer that probably he wanted to die in Vietnam. And it's the sort of thing my dad used to talk about a lot. But I'd say over the last 10 years, I don't think he's ever really mentioned that again, and I'm a bit too afraid to raise questions of death and dying.
Yeah,
and
right.
It's like, this is the moment when you have to start thinking about these issues. But I think it just sort of raised this whole idea of community and who was inside, who was outside.
Mm.
And I'm very conscious that, someone like me very much exists on the peripheries of the Vietnamese community. But that's why... I become a writer.
Yeah.
And all writers, I would say, have this feeling too of just, belonging sort of slightly on the edge of things, because that's what gives you the space to observe and to think. Most people who are in the thick of it don't necessarily need to think about these things. Why would you then question your sense of belonging and identity when you completely belong and your identity feels very coherent?
Yeah.
But a lot of us, who get drawn to writing or some kind of creative expression have these kinds of questions. But I do have to constantly remind myself that I represent a particular viewpoint, and many people would never think about these questions. You meet many Vietnamese Australians who seem very unfazed by being Vietnamese or Australian or both or neither. But when I think about my parents and then myself, like, it's so fraught with just thinking about where we belong.
Yeah.
My parents feel very much like displaced people. Their identity is Vietnamese. Like, they were fully formed adults when they arrived here, as I mentioned. And they're not really, and they never will be Australian in the sense that, you know, that I could be Australian.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet even I don't necessarily feel Australian in a lot of ways. I feel very conflicted about that. My daughter, on the other hand, will have a very different sense of this growing up. You know, she will kind of have married into the culture in some ways. And when I say that, I mean, I guess I mean Anglo-Australian culture. But even in Josh's family, you know, there is some Indigenous heritage too.
Yeah.
And I think that really anchors you to Australia. Whereas for me, I feel like I'm, you know, somehow by an accident through history, I'm here now and making the best of it. But having said that, there are certainly many times where I do feel very Australian.
Yeah.
I feel my limitations as an Australian often as well, especially when I've been in Europe and that. And then when I'm, and that's one thing that's been very liberating about spending time in other places and being a complete outsider is that, you know, when I was living in Belgium, people could see my Asian face, but actually they would interact with me as an Australian.
Yeah, right. That's kind of wonderful.
It is wonderful. It's very freeing, and that's something that I have really enjoyed, I continue to enjoy about living in places outside of Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
In Australia, I do feel the burden of my heritage in that way, which is really not the case when you're abroad. The same in England. When I was in England, and I'm, you know, I've been thinking about that time, I've never really written about it. You know, I spent a year on a working holiday in London. But when I look back on that year, it's very rare that I felt fraught about having some kind of, you know, Vietnamese cross-cultural identity. I just felt it as an Australian. And I think that's why I keep getting drawn into being overseas. I think it's just a bit of a mental break, for one thing.
Wow. But it's obviously very different in Vietnam. I remember there's a piece that you wrote about the first time you went to Vietnam and your father was really kind of resistant to that idea for a while, right?
Yeah, I mean, and that's another thing I often think about too, because, you know, in everyone's life there are these big moments that really change things.
Yeah.
And the big moment that changed my life was going to Vietnam for the first time in 2010. But I suddenly had that desire to go much earlier than that. I would have gone in my early 20s. I would have spent a year there. I applied for a volunteer position, but then my father was so upset by that idea, which seemed really counter to what I'd been raised to think about. Like, you know, I was always raised to think about Vietnam being the real homeland. And so finally, you know, when I'm like, yes, I want to go to the homeland, my dad's like, no, you can't go. It's a communist government. And so in that way, I didn't have that choice in the end. I mean, I suppose I could have fought and I could have just gone, but it just seemed like such a huge risk to lose, you know, my relationship with my parents over a search of what is their homeland, a bit less of mine. But I think if I had been allowed to go in my younger years, I would have turned out to be quite a different person, actually. I might have just ended up in Vietnam for many years. I don't know, like, how that would have worked out, but I would have had a very different sense of, you know, questions of identity and belonging if I'd been allowed to go when I was younger.
Yeah, right. And the first time you went, it was with your now husband, who'd been there before, right?
Yeah, I mean, he spent 6 months living there. I mean, and we have a very interesting relationship because I really feel like we embody like a very successful cross-cultural relationship because I've married an Anglo who's very different to other kinds of Anglos, perhaps, because he speaks Chinese and he's a scholar, though. I mean, he's very nerdy about his interests in China and Vietnam. And, yeah, when he was younger, in his 20s, he spent 6 months, you know, living in Hanoi. So, in fact, in that way, you know, he sort of has provided another bridge into Vietnam for me in an unexpected way. So when I went to Vietnam, like, it was a place that he'd already been to a few times. He'd been to Ho Chi Minh City, but I hadn't at all. But he understood how challenging it was for me to be there. And I think having his support was really important because it ended up just being such a epic emotional time in my life. And, of course, it was going to be. Like, how could it not be? But that first journey was... Now I look back and it seems so different in my life too, because I was like now, I mean, almost 8 years ago, and a lot has changed since then in terms of my thinking about these issues.
I love in one of the pieces, there's another character who refers to it as this overseas Vietnamese trauma stuff, just like kind of half flippantly, but also, like, deadly serious.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, like, that Vic Gill trauma, like, that's, as an adult too, especially I would say over the last 5 years, I've gotten to know quite a lot of Vietnamese or even people who have mixed heritage or might be Anglo and Vietnamese who really understand, you know, this basically this intergenerational trauma. And we didn't really have that language growing up. I mean, I started a psychology degree, but I don't remember ever discussing a concept like intergenerational trauma.
It's really new, isn't it?
I think it's relatively new. I've been meaning to do a bit more research into thinking where these terms, you know, really started and how they, you know, became part of, you know, our lexicon. But people who have Vietnamese heritage generally, I mean, and not just Vietnamese, I'd say lots of other migrant groups as well, we really connect on this level of, oh, wow, isn't intergenerational trauma, isn't that such a, you know, awful thing? And yet it also shapes you in so many ways as well. So I do find that now meeting other Vietnamese, there's always like this kind of shared ground, if they're willing to go there, and not all Vietnamese will. Like sometimes I'll meet someone from a Vietnamese background and they don't necessarily want to put that identity, you know, first and foremost. They'd rather relate on other terms, and I get that as well.
Yeah. I mean, can we talk a little bit more about Bankstown and La Kemba? When we were corresponding, you told me a great story about coming to Sydney Uni for the first time and suddenly realising where it was that you kind of live.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking here at Sydney Uni today. And, I mean, that's another hugely formative experience of my life. Like it is for many people, I think that's, you know, for many people, going to university really opens your eyes to the world. And it's also your first real step into adulthood probably as well. Yeah, so I grew up, you know, quite oblivious to a lot of the, I would say, the fault lines of Sydney around the western suburbs or the eastern suburbs. I mean, I remember I really loved Looking for Ali Brandy by Melina Marchetta, but then in there's a section which talks about the east and the west and that, but I think that would have been completely lost to me at the time. I don't think I understood that.
I remember that piece. I understood it as racialized, right? Because I think she also talks about how it's sort of like, you know, the rich girls end up with the rich boys, but she also says like the wogs end up with the wogs. And I kind of originally read that as just a sort of, all right, cool. A kind of, yeah, a thing that was a division along kind of the way you look sort of a thing. But yeah, that similar experience. I didn't realize there was a class thing going on until much later.
So when I was in high school, there was an opportunity to go to Sydney Uni on this shadow scheme where you could follow a student around for a couple of days. And, I mean, that was probably one of the first times in my life where I was independent enough to catch a train to the city and to come to university. And I really loved the campus. I mean, I did fall in love with the campus of, you know, the university. I had a very nice young man who I followed around for a couple of days, going to classes. And I think that was when I really felt like this was going to be my escape out of, not necessarily, you know, well, actually, yeah, probably was an escape out of my family more than anything, more than the suburbs, I would say. It was more than my family. So then coming to Sydney Uni, that's when I started to sort of have this sense that, oh, I actually come from a geographic area or a class background that's different to lots of people. And perhaps because it was Sydney Uni, I started to meet lots of people who'd gone to private schools, lots of people who, you know, grew up in the North Shore or the eastern suburbs or elsewhere. And then I found myself naturally gravitating towards certain kinds of people, like people who came probably from migrant backgrounds I found a bit easier to relate to, or if they weren't migrant, if they're from the western suburbs. Like I became very friendly with a guy who grew up in Chester Hill, very close to where I grew up, and he went to Chester Hill High. I went to Sefton. And he actually was one of the first Jewish people I ever met. I mean, I had joked about him being probably the only Jew in the western suburbs, but he had mixed heritage and, you know, he was this half American Anglo-Jewish guy randomly who'd grown up in, you know, in Chester Hill. But then I'd meet people like that and then I would naturally feel like we had something in common.
Yeah.
But then you meet people, and like there was this, and the story I told you was, there was this guy that I sort of met through, you know, friends or something. And then his comment to me, like after he, you know, we've been talking a while, he goes, oh, you don't sound like a Westie. And I was like, what does that even mean? And I remember I was affronted. I was thinking, what does that even mean? I think at the time people used to talk about Westies.
Yeah.
I don't think people talk about that now. I don't think that language was quite dated.
Yeah. Bogan, but not Westie.
Yes, we know, I mean, I don't think Bogan was part of the lexicon back then either. But then what Westies was a thing. And it would get reinforced every now and then. Someone would mention that. And I remember also, like, I had a boss who'd grown up in the North Shore and he went to North Sydney Boys. And he was saying that for him growing up, Westies to him were like, I don't know, black denim jeans, and like he had this idea of what a Westie was. So it was a thing, which yeah. I don't think now we think about it quite the same way.
It's so funny. The stuff I always remember was kind of, I remember one girl asking me if we had cows in the backyard. And I was like, you do know it's part of Sydney, right? Like, I don't live on a farm. Because, it took me an hour and a half to get into uni because I was in sort of a public transport black hole. And another student asking me, when I got my first HECS statement and I made a big kind of like, oh, look at me, I'm in debt now. And she was like, if you pay it up front, you get a 25% discount.
Yes.
And I was like, right. And she's like, why didn't you just pay it up front?
It's true. Lots of people mention that.
Yeah.
I mean, thinking back to that time now, it's so interesting and formative in terms of thinking about class.
Mm.
Because really that's what it's more about.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not necessarily about geographic area, but a lot more to do with class. And I definitely felt that, going to classes with people who, were from, very privileged backgrounds. Like, I remember there was a girl who was mixed heritage, actually. She was, I think, half Japanese and half Anglo. And she, got $50 pocket money a week or something. And then for summer holidays, and they'd go overseas and as a family.
Yeah.
I think she went to PLC, actually. Just, like, people would very casually talk about going on skiing holidays with their family and things like that. And I was like, oh, wow, this is how rich people live. And I really didn't have a sense of that growing up.
Yeah.
And I don't think I even had a sense of shame about the Western suburbs even. There wasn't even that. But it was certainly a consciousness that was formed that something about the way I grew up was going to be very different to lots of people that I'd meet at university. But having said that, there was a time where I'd hang out with all these guys who went to Sydney Grammar, for example, but there was some common ground there because, for one thing, they were all very nerdy.
Yeah.
And I was a nerd. And that being a nerd seemed to trump, class considerations. Same with being a migrant. So if, kids who are from wealthier backgrounds but were some kind of migrant, I found that that also meant we could maybe bridge that difference a little bit.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, it's funny that though, but because I think having that formative time in my life at Sydney Uni, it just made me very good, I think, at also trying to find common ground with people that were very different to me. Instead of being scared of people who are different, I think I really kind of leaned into that. And I'm always searching for people who I might have something in common with, but on the surface, it may not appear that way at all.
Mm.
But if they went to a private school, but then they were a scholarship student, probably I'd have more in common with them, So, but I think it was just such an important time in my life going to university because it just really opened up Sydney and opened up the world, in fact, in ways that, having gone to school in Southwest Sydney and spending most of my life there, I didn't necessarily have that sense of a greater Sydney.
Hmm. And I find it really interesting that you mentioned too that you plan to move back. You're living in Waller Creek now and you'd like to go back to Bankstown.
Yeah.
I think that's fantastic.
Well, I mean, it's always been on the cards, actually.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people that I'm friends with who grew up in the area, none of them live in Southwest Sydney anymore.
Yeah.
They all moved up for various reasons. In some ways, I mean, that's another fascinating thing that I think about a lot is about internal migration.
Mm.
I think about, there's these kind of pathways within Sydney that, depending on your background, you end up kind of following perhaps. Like people who grew up in Southwest Sydney who now have moved to Epping or have moved, I mean, for example, I know someone whose brother, and they're Vietnamese, his brother, I think he intermarried, into Anglo culture, but now lives in Tarawamara. And I'm like, oh my God, he must be one of the very few Vietnamese who live in Tarawamara. Because that's a bit of an atypical pathway.
Yeah, yeah.
But then for me, it's hard to explain because my relationship with Western suburbs is very complex and probably more complex than lots of other people's in that not only did I grow up there, but then even as an adult in terms of the jobs that I took, a lot of them were also in the Western suburbs. And I didn't necessarily feel a great desire to have a job in the CBD.
Yeah.
Which is more typical, I think, if you work in the corporate sector and that. But because I ended up in some strange, nebulous career of, communications work and that.
Yeah.
I mean, I worked in Liverpool for many years. I worked there for almost 5 years in a couple of different jobs. My first job out of university was in Ashfield, which is, I guess, on the borderlands of the Western suburbs, but very much a Chinese area. And actually, at the time that I was there, it was still not fully Chinese. Now it has become very Chinese. So I think going back and living in, you know, Southwest Sydney, it's very much in keeping with the way you have this very fluid relationship with, you know, with Bankstown, with the Western suburbs. I'm part of it, but also not part of it too. So even as I was growing up in the Western suburbs, having said all of that, I think my head was always very much like, you know, elsewhere as well. Like, I was a huge reader when I was young. I was a huge letter writer. I had boxes and boxes of letters with pen pals from all around the world. So even if I was physically located, you know, living in George's Hall, in my head, I think I was a real citizen of the world from a young age. And I really valued those kinds of, you know, interactions with people from other places, which also happened within the borders of Western Sydney too. And that's the thing about Western Sydney. It's a very cosmopolitan region. It's very multicultural. But yeah, so it's funny with, kind of having all these memories of growing up in George's Hall and Bankstown and then thinking, you know, now in the future, that will be part of my life again. And in some ways it's very pleasing in a narrative sense. I feel like it comes, you know, I'm coming full circle. But the other thing that's really important, and the reason why I'm even more motivated now, and before it was a theoretical thought, but now that I have a child who's mixed race, I think very much about cultural maintenance. I think about how can I, you know, give her a sense of Vietnamese identity and Vietnamese language skills. And if I, you know, move back to the area where there's a lot more of the community there, that will give her a lot more exposure to Vietnamese language.
Yeah.
Like if we go shopping in Bankstown on a Saturday morning. And then, I mean, and the thing is, like, it will have to be like a concerted effort. It will have to be something that I construct and something that I actually, you know, actively think about. Growing up, it didn't have to happen because both my parents spoke Vietnamese. We spoke at home. We're very much in the bosom of the Vietnamese community. But now that's not where I am, where my parents are either. And then having a daughter who has this mixed heritage, I think there's that richness growing up in somewhere like Bankstown where I can sort of try to recreate a little bit of that for her.
Yeah, that's wonderful. What a wonderful idea.
Yeah, I mean, and not everyone necessarily, you know, worries about this to the same extent I do, but, you know, since I was pregnant last year and then having a baby, the main thought that I have is actually how can I help her speak Vietnamese? And I do have Vietnamese language skills, but I feel slightly inadequate about it too.
Yeah.
So I have quite childlike, you know, vocabulary. But that's where I think about just in terms of Western Sydney, that's why it's such a hugely important part of my life still. And I'm regularly there, even though I currently don't live there. But because that's where I still have some sense of the Vietnamese community. But then maybe it goes back to that whole idea we discussed earlier about being on the outside. If I wasn't on the outside, I wouldn't necessarily feel like this. But even though I was, you know, living there for so long, I guess that exposure was quite natural there, whereas now I'm outside, I don't get to have that same kind of exposure.
Yeah, yeah. That's fascinating. To change tack entirely, can you tell me a bit about bioethics? So I know that's your field at the moment, right? Like one of the things that I found... I should have said this first. One of the things that I found so interesting at kind of looking at so much of your work is that you've got such a diverse practice that you've made radio as well as writing, and you've worked in public health as well as sort of journalism. Some of your stuff is about philosophy, some of it's about music, and some of it's about science and ethics in this really kind of fascinating way. And it sort of struck me that I don't think I've read such a wide-ranging body of work for a really long time.
Yeah, I think I have quite a singular...
That's a compliment, by the way.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that as a compliment. And it's not even intentional that it's become this way, but that is what's happened. I've ended up just constantly, you know, changing tack or going back to things and, you know, it's shifting constantly. And that's something I have thought a lot about the last few years. So currently I'm doing a PhD. It's a bit more focused on just healthcare, public healthcare, but very much kind of health systems research. So I'm now thinking about it in terms of systems. But no, ethics is something that I'm...
Good, because those systems are broken.
Yes, well, I'm looking at pregnant women's experiences too, of public healthcare, because of my experiences last year at a public hospital. It was really fascinating and frustrating. And we do have excellent first world care in Australia somehow, despite how dysfunctional the system is as well. But... yeah, I mean, in terms of, like, how I've ended up across all these different divides, it goes back to, I think in some ways I've thought about this, and one way to construct the story is it has a lot to do with growing up feeling different to everyone. So So part of the narrative would be, you know, when I went to primary school in George's Hall, just for like a year or two there, I was the only Asian girl in the entire year. There were a couple other Chinese guys. But that really reinforced this sense of, like, difference in values in yeah. some way. It wasn't even necessarily, like, articulated like that, but I felt it. But then after that, I went to a school where I was a very multicultural school again. So it was this very brief window, which made me feel very different. And then I think that that thinking about the fact is I felt somehow, you know, that we have different values. Not all of us kind of have the same,
yeah.
You know, sense of what's right and what's wrong. I think that's what forms my understanding and interest in ethics, actually. So when I was in undergrad studying at Sydney Uni, I was doing psychology, and then I got really drawn into history and philosophy of science. And part of that involves ethics. So when I was, you know, learning a bit more about, you know, ethics and science, it just started to raise broader questions around, you know, ethics at a societal level. So I think that's kind of how I've sort of ended up, you know, coming into bioethics, and I had an opportunity to do a master's in it a few years ago. But I found all these things, you know, at some level, they're all related, all this stuff about being the in-between, because
yeah, right.
ethics is, you know, about also the in-between spaces, the grey areas. I grew up in a very, you know, in a grey area of being Vietnamese Australian, and even the academic studies, you know, I'm in the grey area between science and arts yeah. and humanities.
Yeah, I've always thought, so somehow I ended up with a whole bunch of science PhDs as friends when I was at uni, and listening to them talk about their work when they were deep in that research thing, was I sort of realised, especially listening to one of them who deals a lot with numbers and who was sort of doing bioinformatics, so like statistician on crack. but the way he talked about this work, it seemed to me that it was all about finding patterns and making shapes out of the kind of gross chaotic material of the world. And I suddenly went, huh, that's exactly what I'm doing with my poems. I feel like it's sort of the same impulse, just two kind of ends that we're taught to think of as being completely opposite, right? Like science and imagination. But I think it's all about a curiosity, right? And that kind of narrative drive. It's just the narratives you find are different.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I agree that they're manifestations of, you know, similar impulses. Having said that, though, what really drove me more towards the ethics end of science is that it's that there is this kind of monolithic kind of idea of what science is as
yeah.
well, which bugged me. Even at that young age at university, I'd get into arguments with people. Like, people were very, like, you know, deterministic about biology and saying, you know, well, if you're unable to have children, well, then that's it. Why do you need some kind of intervention? You know, I mean, that's just one way of thinking about it. Well, I remember I had an argument with someone about, well, we're meant to be, humans were designed to be omnivorous, so being vegetarian is, you know, like going against nature in some way. And I just found that kind of black and white thinking really
yeah,
bugged me
yeah,
in science,
yeah.
actually. So that's what, you know, with, and in fact, you know, now talking out loud, I mean, all monolithic stories
yeah.
really bug me. So that's what drives a lot of my writing and work and thinking, is trying to challenge those kind of very monolithic narratives. And science is a kind of, people have a very religious view of science, in that, you know, people hold up as some, you know, science has all the solutions, it's the most objective thing, but it's not true at all. It's just
yeah, it's
another
bullshit.
Yeah, well, just as you say, it's just another form of human expression in some ways. And we've constructed a lot of these ideas of science, and in fact, a lot of people don't even really know what science is. It's a process, it's a methodology, it's about proving things are right or disproving other things. But it's also very slippery. And I mean, and that's really fascinating to think about, actually. And that's why there's a real source of inspiration for writing, I think, as part of that.
Yeah. It's the changeability of science that fascinates me, how, you know, what we know slips, you know, from year to year and decade to decade, the more that we kind of find out about the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that's the same with all art as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, the more you sort of go deeper into it, the more you realise how little you know about anything. And science is part of that as well. And that frustrates me when people don't seem to appreciate that about science, that it is shifting, that, you know, one generation will think this, but then the next generation will think something different. So I've kind of been interested in writing a bit more about that because it's just another source of fascination for me.
Mm.
I think that's why I've been struggling with writing a book, actually.
Mm.
It's something that's been in the back of my mind for a long time now, but I haven't quite worked out my way through because of my very disparate interests and, you know, the way that my thinking is very organic in the way it sort of goes from one thing to the next. And I think the discipline of a book is that you're very coherent about a particular sort of, you know, way of looking at an idea,
yeah,
or whatever. I mean, I'm getting closer, but in a way I'm not in a huge rush either. I mean, I'll just get to it in my own time. And I'm a real believer in getting things in your own time in that way.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing I discovered was that maybe the way I lived my life was going to be very different to other people's. I mean, and everyone's is. I mean,
yeah.
But then certainly some people have a slightly more conventional narrative in terms of how they live their life and the milestones they reach at certain times,
yep,
whereas some of us...
Oh, it took me so long to figure that out. And even now sometimes I'm like, but I haven't. And I'm like, yeah, because I don't want to.
Well, that's right. And I think, well, right, if you wanted to, you would have gotten there by now.
Yeah.
But that's one thing I really dread, writing bios about myself for, like, programs. And in 50 words or 100 words, I'm like, oh, my God, what am I going to put in this time? What am I going to leave out? So I often have a very modified bio for every,
yeah,
single thing. And the only place where it's a bit more uniform is probably on my one-page website, where I get a bit more space,
yeah,
to sort of list all the different things that I do and talk a little bit about myself in some coherent way.
Actually, I did want to ask, you are working on a book at the moment, aren't you? Is it the collaborative book with Felicity and...
Oh, Beth? Yeah, I'm doing that. Yes, that's,
yeah,
right.
And are you working on your own as well?
Yeah, so I have been collaborating with Felicity Castagna and Faith Chaza on a young adult book. And that's been a really interesting and great process because a lot of writing is very solo. So writing a young adult novel with three different perspectives has been quite a fascinating exercise in trying to come together to tell a story. But aside from that, you know, I do spend a lot of time just working on my own projects as well. I mean, when I find the time, which, you know, is increasingly hard to find with a baby as well. But, yeah, like, and I'm
amazed, by the way, by women with babies who write. I think you guys are, like, superhuman.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. Not all women have this experience, of course. I totally understand why some,
yeah,
people just find it absolutely exhausting. For me, it's actually been a really great creative time in my life this year. I've had a lot of time for reading. I've been reading a lot more poetry and reading all kinds of things. Have a lot more space for thinking, funnily enough. Maybe because I get just enough sleep each night. But also because I've always functioned very well, I guess, on limited sleep.
Yeah, right.
So the impact hasn't been, you know, so horrendous in terms of that. But, yeah, I've actually kind of gotten a lot of a lot more, you know, and I've gotten, you know, a lot of time to think about, you know, a book idea,
yeah,
that I've been struggling with for a long time, which is pretty much everything we've talked about. How do I bring all this together?
Yeah, yeah.
Or do I need to? But then having a child has sort of focused my thinking a lot. And I'd say that I've read a couple of books this year which really helped me think about this. And for example, one is Mouse by Art Spiegelman.
Oh, yeah, beautiful.
And another one this year, which I loved, was The Best We Could Do by T-Boy. They're both graphic novels, and I really love the form of graphic novels.
Mm.
And basically both of those books are a lot to do with how do you, you know, pass down stories through generations,
yeah,
essentially, and how do you deal with intergenerational trauma? And so those are two big questions in my life too. So I'm getting a bit closer now. I think having read those kinds of works, having a child, and then just thinking about where I'm up to. And with memoir, I mean, I'm a bit conflicted about this idea of writing a memoir,
yeah,
about myself.
Well, do what I did and just call it essays. And...
yeah, yeah. Absolutely that. And I've had that conversation with other people too. They're like, oh, Fiona did.
Don't call it memoir. You're fine.
But the thing about memoir, though, is I do read a lot of memoir.
Mm.
I love reading memoir, and I have for a long time. And I love essays as well. So those forms I really gravitate towards naturally anyway. But... yeah, I guess I'm up to the stage now where I think what someone said to me once was memoir is like a wisdom project.
Nice.
And now that I'm in my mid-30s, I don't know how wise I am, but I suddenly have a lot more wisdom than 10 years ago when I was thinking about these issues.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, now my writing is starting to deal with these issues in a slightly more complicated way. But I also don't want to rush these things. I don't think,
yeah,
the only thing that makes me feel a bit anxious is probably the thought of like death, you know? And I think, okay, well, hopefully I have a while longer to go. But that's every time when I'm on a plane and there's turbulence and I think, oh my God, I haven't written a book yet. You know, this is not the moment to die. Like, I need to sort of, you know, write this out and eventually get to this book.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You can add that too. So
that's where we're actually going to end. On
death.
Oh dear. Thank you so much.
Thank
it was
you.
So much fun.
No, that was fun. Thank you so much.
6 Degrees from the City is supported by the Crown Packer Foundation, the Sydney Review of Books, and the Writing and Society Research Centre at Western Sydney University. Our theme music is by Field Fadul, and production assistance is by Ben Denham. Thank you for listening, and see you again soon.